p.m. Tuesday, March 2nd. Welcome, everybody. Present, we have Representatives Klayman, Story, Kaufman, Tarr, and Vance. So six members present. We have a quorum to conduct business. And thank you, Tom, with LAO and the House Recording Secretary for facilitating today's meeting. And as I think all members know, we're on a time diet with finance subcommittees. So Department of Administration Finance Subcommittee will convene at 4 o'clock today. And I'm going to try to have us gaveled out at 3:50 to have a little bit of a buffer between Standing Committee and Finance Subcommittee. The two items on today's agenda are House Bill 3, second hearing from Representative Johnson relating to disaster declarations, as well as House Bill 18 relating to National Board certification, a first hearing from my office. So we previously heard House Bill 3, and there was questions from the committee as well as invited testimony. And also let the record reflect Representative Eastman joined us at 3:02 p.m. So with House Bill 3 on the agenda today, we have public testimony as well as consideration of amendments, and then we'll look to the will of the committee for a motion. So at this point, I'm going to open testimony on House Bill 3. And things are a little bit simplified because there's not ever going to be testimony in the room. Unless we're in for a surprise, but online, looks like we have Katie Botts from Juneau. Ms. Botts, if you can hear us, please put yourself on the record and present your testimony on House Bill 3 in 3 or less minutes.
Yes, sir. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you. Please proceed.
Sorry about that. My name is Katie Boats. I am a constituent in Juneau, Alaska, and I am representing myself. I am in full support of House Bill 3. I think that any and all Alaskan government entities need to be aware of cybersecurity, especially now that we are in 2021. There has been many cases around the world where people are hacking into government entities, and we need to protect our own government entities. And as a concerned constituent of public safety and, you know, just the safety of everyone in Alaska, I go for cybersecurity as well, because it is extremely easy to hack into the internet these days, and I realize how easy it was to hack. So if I can make a suggestion to the House State Affairs Committee to write in a fiscal note to include what's called a B as in Victor, P as in pencil, N as in number. BPN is a little system that the state government legislative branch could install into all of our government entities to help protect and secure our state entities from being hacked. It's like a secure it's a secure mechanism. I've noticed on like our basis, our DMV is not secured, and that really concerns me. And as a concerned citizen, I'm also looking into ways to help protect our state from being hacked through cybersecurity. I'm always learning. I'm always trying to find ways to help our state. So as we go along, I'm more than willing to give insight to the state. And that's the first thing that I saw. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Boats, for your testimony, and apologies for mispronouncing your name at the outset. I don't see any other testifiers online, and I don't think there's anyone in the audience here to testify. So at this time, I'm going to close public testimony on House Bill 3. That takes the bill back before the committee for consideration of amendments. And before 5 o'clock p.m. amendment deadline yesterday, there were two amendments submitted, one from Representative Klayman and another from my office. So we'll maybe take them in that order. Representative Klayman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move amendment, well, I'll call it amendment number one, that relates to the definition in the United States Code.
I'll object for purposes of discussion. Representative Klayman, would you be willing to offer maybe just a, I think we all remember the discussion from last week, but.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So amendment number one provides a reference to the United States Code for the definition of critical infrastructure. And I didn't want to create a definition that every year or two we came in and somebody said, oh, the federal definition changed or the federal law changed on this, and so we have to keep coming back and amending because I see this as one where we're being led more by the federal disaster declaration definitions than by our local state definitions. And so what the amendment does is it references Section 42 U.S.C. 5195 Section CE, and that's the definition that I believe is the foundation for the definitions of critical infrastructure that are in the materials, and that I also believe gives the flexibility for the federal government through regulations to both expand and contract the definition of critical infrastructure within the meaning of this portion of the U.S. Code.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, more of a comment. In some of our late-breaking work, just looking at this and thinking about it more, we wanted to confirm that the USC definition is inclusive of intrastate networks. As written, it references interstate networks. So that may be a nuance to just confirm before we proceed.
Representative Klayman.
My only query actually for Representative Kaufman, intra and inter always sound very similar, and I'm not sure I was tracking your comment between inter and intra.
Intra, the former, through the chair, and interstate, as written, it appears to only include interstate networks.
You mean INTER networks?
Yes, sir.
You mean the federal definition? I'm actually looking at the definition in the U.S. Code. I don't see any reference to inter-INTER state or intra-INTRA state. I don't think it's mentioned in either instance in the federal code, although I think you're correct that as a matter of commerce clause control, the federal government really doesn't have the capacity to regulate intra-INTRA state, so you'd have a commerce clause issue if the federal statute pretended to control activities strictly within the state. But I view this definition as actually describing the facilities more than anything, and I don't see how that's actually going to have a lot of impact here in Alaska because, frankly, we don't have a lot of interstate things that are in both or crossing borders. I think if we were in North Dakota to South Dakota, it might be more of a concern.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. I think I see your point, Representative Kaufman, as far as what is being captured here using the federal definition is somewhat limiting because it's not dealing with the things that are vital and critical to Alaska. but only those things that are vital and critical to Alaska that the United States as a country also recognizes are vital and critical to the country as a whole. I think it might be helpful if we were to take the definition here and in the part where it says, you know, where it limits it to the things that are so vital to the United States, we were instead to replace that with so vital to the state of Alaska, I think would capture a much broader aspect of critical items here in Alaska that wouldn't otherwise be captured under the federal code if we just copied it word for word.
All right. Feels like we're entering a rat's nest. Any other comments from the committee before maybe adjudicating a path forward here? Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair Kreis Tompkins, Rep Story. I believe that using the federal definition and having the United States there, it does include Alaska. And we, even though it does include states that we do most business with, Seattle, other, anyway, I just feel that's all inclusive when we have United States. And there, so I speak in favor of the motion, the amendment.
Representative Kaufman.
Thank you, through the chair. We wanted to get an opinion on this before coming down, but just didn't have time with everything that was going on. So that may be the path forward.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do think it's problematic because when you read this definition, I could think there'd be infrastructure. There could be a cyber attack on infrastructure in Alaska that would be critical for us but would not rise to the level of importance as being considered critical infrastructure to the United States. I can think of like local cell networks or something like that. Just the examples that this bill sponsor gave were really debilitating for those local communities. But I don't think that the, you know, network outages in Wasilla would be considered like critical infrastructure of the United States, right, of that level of importance, if that's the way we're defining this. So the definition is, you know, that it's systems and assets, whether physical or virtual, so vital to the United States, right, that the incapacity. So if we are looking at Alaska-based assets that are critical for us, seems it does need to be more defined in that way.
Representative Kim, do you know, is there a list of, under this section of U.S. Code, a list of the types of infrastructure assets that are included?
So in the U.S. Code, they do not have that. It's a fairly broad definition, and a perfect example is what came with the sponsor's package, which lists the whole range of things that fit within the definition. This is actually an example, I would say, of we can spend a lot of time going through spinning down. There's nothing in the federal definition that says it has to be interstate. It can be within the state and can be considered critical infrastructure under this definition. It's, you know, like the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, for example, would be a transportation structure that if put into risk for cybersecurity never leaves the state of Alaska, but it would be, in everybody's definition, would count as critical infrastructure. And the decision to find an emergency based on critical infrastructure is very, very, very unlikely for somebody to go down to this level. It's more going to be somebody who's going to say, does this rate as critical infrastructure? And somebody would say, well, yeah, the telephone network in the Mat-Su, for example, is critical infrastructure. And I think that it would meet this definition. The risks that are identified are a concern. I think the main point is to at least somebody has a framework of which to reference. And when you look at the example that came from the sponsors list, communications, chemical, critical manufacturing, commercial facilities, dams, defense industrial base, emergency services, energy, financial, government facilities, food and agriculture, nuclear reactors, material and waste, information technology, healthcare and public health, transportation systems, and water. Those are the examples that, in looking at this bill, those are the kinds of systems that are critical infrastructure, and we would all agree that those are critical infrastructure.
Representative Eastman, and then I'll make a comment and see if I can focus us towards point of action. Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. Yeah, I would like to think that, in response to the previous comment, that our, boots on the ground, if you will, like those at the Mat-Su Borough that we spoke of in our last hearing, would be able to make those kind of judgment calls with regard to what is critical and not critical and so forth. But I remember when we asked the question in our last hearing, weren't you able to, reference the critical nature of the attack they experienced and get a disaster declaration out of that? And the answer that we got back was no. Even though they wanted to, they weren't able to go through the disaster declaration process to conclusion because there was some technical language in the statute that didn't allow for that, and which is why, partly why, we're here today to deal with that. So it would seem to me that under the same, rationale, if, a borough attorney in one of the boroughs is looking at this definition and saying, vital to the United States, they might have to say, no for the same reasons, and we might be back, 2 years from now or next year for the same reason, trying to flesh out how we can make the language work for those local governments.
Okay. Well, thank you for committee comments. My own personal perspective here is it might be a little bit half a dozen of one, six of the other are pretty low stakes here, as I think the sort of broad sweep of what this legislation is trying to do is clear, and I think this definition probably adds more clarity than otherwise. So I'm just going to remove my objection, see if we can proceed to consideration. Is there further objection to adoption of Amendment Number 1?
I'll object.
Great. Let's see. I'm going to take a quick at ease. Number one.
Could I just have one quick follow-up? Could we find out where the bill sponsor is with respect to Amendment Number 1 to the sponsor's bill?
Sure. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Delana Johnson. And I don't have the exact reference here, but my understanding is that the continuation of the, first of all, I want to say I'm fine with the amendment. My understanding is that the rest of that act still leaves it up to DMVA to define the critical infrastructure, and it doesn't exclude interstate. So I don't have a problem with the amendment.
Great. Thank you, Representative Johnson. Great. Do you maintain your objection, Representative Eastman? Okay. And I think with that, we're going to go to the recording secretary. If you're online, would the recording secretary please be able to call the roll on adoption of Amendment Number 1?
Representative Tarr.
No.
Representative Story.
Yes.
Representative Klayman.
Yes.
Representative Vance.
No.
Representative Kaufman.
No.
Representative Eastman.
No.
Chair Chris Tompkins.
Yes.
3 yeas, 4 nays.
By a vote of 3-4, adoption amendment number 1 fails, and that takes us to the consideration of the next amendment in the committee. Representative Klayman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move now Amendment Number 2, which has multiple instances of adding the words or a political subdivision of the state to the bill.
Thank you, and I'll object for purposes of discussion. And just for clarity, the work draft number on this amendment is A.3, so amendment number 2 is A.3 in the upper right-hand corner. And this is an amendment drafted in consultation with the sponsor and Alaska Municipal League that adds additional clarity about just what entities are able to request a disaster declaration, namely cities and municipalities. There's also a letter from AML that should be on members' desks that provide additional context. And with that, any questions from the committee, Representative Eastman?
Thank you, through the chair. And just to get some further clarity on the reason or the intent behind the amendment, I'm looking at where the language is changing, and this is going to, you know, add any lower subdivision in the state. And does that change the nature of what constitutes a state disaster? I mean, because there are situations I can think of. You know, we just had flooding in my district here within the last 2 years that rose to the level of a disaster for my district and for the borough, but was not eligible to be a state disaster. Obviously, those locally affected would kind of like that it had been, but the answer came back that it clearly wasn't, and so it didn't rise to that level. Does this, by changing it from state to a political subdivision of state, does that basically equate, you know, if it is a disaster at that political subdivision level, then it would also be a disaster at that state level?
Let's see. Representative Eastman, would you be able to say that question?
Sure.
Once more.
So I'll give you an example that my district dealt with. We had a bridge that was flooded out during the, you know, coldest part of the year, and so there were houses, you know, many houses that were affected. Obviously, the bridge was impassable for a time, and that was judged to be, under our current law, a disaster at the borough level. But when, you know, there was a request from the borough to elevate that and make that a state disaster, the answer came back no, that it wouldn't qualify, because it didn't reach that state level of disaster impacting the state. The impacts were felt at the local level. When we're replacing the word state here in this amendment with a political subdivision of the state, are we intending to say then that in order to be a state disaster, it only needs to be a disaster at that political subdivision of the state? Because right now I think we have a distinction between those two, and if we're replacing state with a political subdivision of the state, are we now equating those two so that the bridge issue in my district would become eligible for a state disaster?
Let's see. Well, I'll defer to the sponsor and her staff for any additional comment, but I'm not sure that analysis tracks with me. Right, for instance, the landslide in Haines affected only Haines, and that rose to the level that, in the governor's discretion and wisdom, that was a disaster on a state level. And apparently the governor, in reviewing the facts of what occurred in your district, found that that did not reach that level. But in both instances, it was purely a local incident. It was not a statewide thing affecting the Aleutians, to Ketchikan, to Kotzebue. So, I guess, well, I'll just leave it there, Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. May I ask a question for a point of clarification for Representative Eastman? On the amendment number 2, are you, it says to after following the second occurrence of state, insert, or a political subdivision, are you thinking that it replaces the word state? Because I'm reading it that it comes after the second occurrence of the word state, so that it would include both the state and the political subdivision. Are we both understanding that correctly?
Yes. What we're doing by adding that, it's basically an either or. So instead of it having to rise to the state level, it can now not rise to the state level and only impact, at least at that portion of the statute, the political subdivision of the state. So I am tracking what you're saying. Yes.
Thank you.
And just a point of clarification, I think what this amendment does is, right now there's ambiguity that if a municipality, or the Mat-Su Borough, for instance, as was illustrated in invited testimony, suffered a complete shutdown because of a cyber attack. The amendment is currently written. There's actually some ambiguity whether the Mat-Su Borough, because it is not the state government, would necessarily be able to request that disaster. And this amendment provides abundant clarity that municipal governments are eligible to request that. Doesn't mean it's a guarantee that it'll be granted. And there might be instances where there's the Haines equivalent of a cyber attack, and then there's the Representative Eastman district example of a cyber attack, and some might get granted and some might not. But I think that's just what this amendment tries to do.
Sure.
Any comments from the sponsor? Or I'm also happy to call on Mr. Cordero.
Thank you for the opportunity, Mr. Chair. So, political subdivision of the state, I mean, all cities are considered a political subdivision, but it's adding to the definition. Not all municipal disasters would rise to the level of a state disaster, but oftentimes the state will step in a city that has a specific disaster to the area, and by doing that allows for federal funding or federal help for something. So that, I believe, is the intent of the amendment. And I don't have a problem with that.
Further questions or comments from the committee? Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Yeah, and having heard the comments, I think I'll be supportive of this amendment. I think it is valuable that we make clear that we are talking about boroughs or the municipalities and so forth. If the amendment passes, though, I think I will have a conceptual amendment in addition, but I'll hold off on that for now.
Can't wait. First conceptual amendment of the session. Representative Johnson.
Thank you. I just also wanted to say that my staff is online if there's any further questions.
Great. Thank you, Representative Johnson. Further questions or comments from the committee on amendment number 2A.3? Great. Well, I made the objection for purpose of discussion. I'll remove my objection. Is there any further objection from the committee? Seeing and hearing none, amendment number 2, work order A.3, is adopted by the committee. And that takes us to the bill as amended. Is there a conceptual amendment? Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And through the chair, I'm glad that we've expanded the definition here, obviously through the bill itself, which is an expansion, and then also through this amendment we just passed. I'm concerned that as I look at it in total now, we've made it overbroad, if you will, and I'm particularly looking at on page 2 of the bill, where we've incorporated now state or political subdivision of the state, and now we've got, as it currently reads, an attack has occurred, or an imminent attack has occurred, or a cybersecurity vulnerability exists, and it seems to me that that there is a possibility that you can have a statute that is too broad, and we may have found that situation here. So I would like to propose a conceptual amendment, and that would simply say that it would remove the vulnerability component, and it would just be dealing with actual attacks that have happened or about to happen. And so the conceptual amendment would be to limit the scope to those attacks that have happened or about to happen, and it would remove the vulnerabilities from, you know, triggering a disaster before anything bad has actually happened. Does that make sense?
It does. And I'll object and just speak briefly, although I would be very interested in hearing sponsors' thoughts as well. I think, as I understand the intent of the amendment, the primary hesitation I have to adoption of that amendment is that I feel comfortable, broadly speaking, in DMVA's and ultimately the governor's discretion in not declaring disasters willy-nilly. And clearly, there's, I think, a lot of discretion and restraint in disaster declarations thus far. And with cybersecurity vulnerabilities, I think if there's, you know, zero-day exploits in state software or whatever that are identified, and it's kind of like, oh my gosh, having sort of all available resources and flexibility strikes me conceptually as being advantageous, even if nothing has yet actually happened. So just comments to explain my objection, but Representative Johnson, any comments?
Thank you. I'll just make a little
comment, and then I would like to ask my staff to weigh in, because I know that he's had, I think he can elaborate a little bit, but I mean, I'm thinking of if you had a particular vulnerability that was widespread and large that you identify, that you could declare disaster and then seek funding or from that. And so sometimes we could be talking about something as large and widespread and is specific. I think that's the concern about things that are overly broad, is that they're not specific enough, but it is a cybersecurity vulnerability. And I know that one of our testifiers spoke to the difference between an imminent attack and an after the fact, and how that all interacted. And I thought he had a good explanation, but I'd rather have my staff, Eric, who's on the line, talk about that.
Mr. Cordero, if you can hear us, can you put yourself on record and provide any additional comment?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Eric Cordero, staff to Representative Delana Johnson. Through the chair, Representative Eastman, thank you for that amendment. As Representative Johnson mentioned, Peter House, who is a cybersecurity expert at the last meeting, made some comments about vulnerabilities, and I do, from the research I've done in the cybersecurity issues, vulnerabilities are something that they do take into account when it comes to how many resources they have to use to fix it, because vulnerabilities are pretty much the base of how people can attack a system. And so, because usually state actors they target vulnerabilities to the state, and so that's why the phrase is important to keep. You can have a vulnerable system, or you can make a system vulnerable by attacking it. You can have both.
Thank you, Mr. Cordero. Further questions or comments from the committee? Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Yes, through the chair, just a comment. I think that's what I heard too, is that we could have a known vulnerability that, wow, we've really got to jump on this and fix it, and then respond in that way. I think to me that sounds like an important utility. Thank you.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My first concern with the word vulnerability and declaring a disaster regarding vulnerability is telling the world that we are vulnerable. However, if I remember the testimony correctly, one of the things that was spoken to in the example of what happened in the Matsu Borough is part of that definition of vulnerability is how many people they can have to work that issue in a quick amount of time, because the more technicians they have to work on it, the sooner they can fix the problem and lighten the current vulnerability. So I think part of the hurdle is what our understanding of vulnerability means in regards to the cybersecurity, and that testimony I think helped me overcome that burden, that it's not just we're declaring, hey, we're vulnerable, but it's a matter of how many personnel, and by saying yes, we see this possible, we see the vulnerability attack, meaning send more help now, right? And the more technicians and help that they can have, the sooner the vulnerability is over. So because of that testimony and understanding, I am comfortable leaving the word vulnerability in light of the other aspects of this definition.
Thank you. Wrap up comments, Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Yes, and I'm recalling back to the testimony from our prior hearing, and the response I got to the question I was asking dealing with vulnerability was that SolarWinds was a good example of a known vulnerability, because we had identified it as a problem. Obviously, it hadn't been attended to yet, and it may not still be completely attended to even today. But that is a vulnerability. You can give it a name. You can have an idea, maybe not exactly, but you can have an idea of what exactly the consequences might be if it's allowed to persist. But we're taking one step further here, and we're not just talking about a known cybersecurity vulnerability, which has already been identified, but we're talking about a cybersecurity vulnerability that may not even occur yet. It might only occur in the near future. And now with the extension to a political subdivision of a state, my reading, and I may be the only one to read it this way, is that we're now opening the definition of state disaster up to a political subdivision. So the municipality of Houston, for example, is in my district, one of our smaller municipalities. And by virtue of the fact that they may have a vulnerability that may occur in the future, that opens it up to a state disaster. And I'll maintain my support for this amendment if for only the fact that I think by broadening this language as broad as we have, we're now opening ourselves up to really a state where, you know, we could be in disasters almost perpetually, and I think I want to avoid that.
I'm going to proceed to a roll call. The recording secretary, if you can hear us, would you please call the roll on the motion to adopt Amendment Number 3 from Representative Eastman?
Representative Eastman.
Yes.
Representative Tarr.
No.
Representative Dory.
No.
Representative Klayman.
No.
Representative Vance.
No.
Representative Kaufman.
No.
Chair Christopherson.
No.
One yay, six nays.
Thank you. And by a vote of one yay and six nays, adoption of Amendment Number 3 fails, which takes us back to the bill as amended before us. I'd like to look to the will of the committee to potentially discharge this legislation. Are there any closing comments on amendment or House Bill Number 3 before we entertain a motion? Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair to all, is it possible we could just adjourn briefly on this and get an opinion? We were trying to contact Ledge Legal before we came down. We just couldn't do it quickly enough. Because it was one of those late, you know, we better check this out. So with regards to the previous question, I would propose that. And maybe we can close that piece of business too.
Brief at ease. On the record, thank you, Representative Kaufman, and I think, yeah, definitely bookmarked as something to look into further. Other comments from the committee on House Bill 3? Representative Klayman?
I'll just note, I think this is a good bill. I look forward to hearing it in Judiciary Committee, and will certainly consider co-sponsoring.
Thank you. Representative Story?
Yes, I also thank the sponsor for bringing this forward. I think it's a good bill, and I also think this committee, being state affairs, should be looking at what protections we have in our state to prevent something like this happening. And so I think it would be a good topic to take up at another time.
Thank you. And noted, Representative Story. Representative Eastman.
Thank you. I support the concept behind the bill and adding cybersecurity to statute. However, I'll be objecting to moving it because I think we're close to having it exactly the way it needs to be, but I don't think we should be putting off those final questions to another committee.
Other comments? Seeing none, a motion. Representative Klayman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move House Bill Number 3, version 32-LS0041/A with as amended with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Thank you. Is there an objection to the motion?
I'll object.
Okay, there's a motion from Representative Eastman. Will the recording secretary please call the roll?
Representative Kaufman.
Aye.
Representative Eastman.
A nay.
Representative Tarr.
Yes.
Representative Story.
Yes.
Representative Clayman.
Yes.
Representative Vance.
Yes.
Chair Christ-Tompkins.
Yes.
Six yeas, one nay.
By a vote of 6 yeas, 1 nay, the motion to discharge House Bill 3 as amended with individual recommendations attached fiscal notes passes the committee. Thank you, Representative Johnson, for bringing the legislation before us. And off to judiciary it goes. And that takes us to the next item on today's agenda, House Bill 18. Just a note that we're going to be very time limited here. So what I will ask is that Norm Wooten from the Alaska Association of School Boards provides invited testimony. House Bill 18 is a mere, 4 or 5 lines long. It establishes a goal for national board certification in the state of Alaska and creates a physical visual designation of teachers who've attained that that certification. And we're pulling up Mr. Wooten's PowerPoint. And Mr. Wooten, can you hear us?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, can you hear me?
Loud and clear, yeah. So I think we'd love to hear your presentation. If it's possible to time box it in the 8 to 10 minute range, that would be ideal. Time allows, we can hear from Ms. Parody and Mr. Claymeyer. But I think that will give us a start on this legislation. So when you're ready, please proceed and just let Mr. Stepp, the committee aide, know when to advance the slides.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will be the very paragon of brevity, I assure you today. For the record, Mr. Chairman, my name is Norm Wooten. I'm the Director of Advocacy for the Association of Alaska School Boards. And if we could go to slide 2, please. This is the Association of Alaska School Boards mission, and the only reason that I do this is that I won't read it for you. You can very well see that. I would like to bring your attention to the phrase that is highlighted in red, that is focused on student achievement. AASB is not about just protecting board members. It's not about advocating necessarily for board members. We are in existence to assist school boards to fulfill their main purpose in educating young people. Slide number 3, please. AASB has the board of directors of AASB has 5 goals, but I just wanted to share with you goal number 4, and that is to support school boards and districts to collaborate and implement creative solutions to deliver personalized learning and prepare Alaska's children and youth for their future. This is pretty self-explanatory, I think, and it's a goal of our board of directors. We could go to slide 4, please. AASB's delegate assembly meets in November, and boards submit resolutions, and these resolutions are debated on the floor and passed by the delegate assembly. Now, as part of that resolutions package, long-standing resolutions that rise to the surface as a foundational element of public education take on additional emphasis as belief statements. AASB's belief statement B20 talks about quality staff improves student learning, and that is high qualified, highly motivated, culturally responsive, and innovative teachers. Slide 5, please. And AASB belief statement 22 talks about educational improvement, and AASB believes that that professional standards should include the highest standards of professionalism, and as they educate our children. And then moving on to the resolutions, slide 6, please. AASB resolution 4.1 is about support for staff development, and I won't go through all of these. You all have copies of this. But the bullet points on AASB Resolution 4.1 could actually come right out of the National Board Certification elements of how teachers attain national board certification. So I won't read those to you. You can see those. And slide 7, please. ASB Resolution 5.23 is about supporting innovation and collaboration to improve student achievement for all Alaska students. And once again, this is about quality teachers and how to ensure that quality teachers are in front of our of the students of our state. Move to slide 8, please. Now, I'll ask the rhetorical question, why do ASB's foundational documents even matter? Well, classroom teachers are what ensures the success of Alaska students. We believe, sincerely believe, that a good teacher can make a difference in whether a student succeeds or fails. And so I ask the question, what does make a good teacher? Continued professional development, mentorship for new or low-performing teachers, professional learning communities that offer opportunities for sharing best practices, and leadership for implementing student achievement strategies. Slide 9, please. So how does this all pertain to National Board certification? Well, NBC requires or teaches and promotes classroom creativity. It requires continual and self-evaluation and self-improvement. It builds leadership within classrooms, school buildings, and school districts. And National Board certification, finally, is about improving instruction, which equals increased student achievement. Slide 10, please. So finally, let's just circle back and look at that mission statement again. To advocate for children and youth by assisting school boards and providing quality public education focused on student achievement through effective local governance. National Board certification is focused on student achievement, and the Association of Alaska School Boards stands behind and supports anything that that talks about increasing and focuses on that student achievement. That exemplifies the National Board certification, and we heartily support this bill and thank the sponsor for bringing it forward. Mr. Chairman, I hope that was brief enough. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Wooten. You are the paragon of brevity. That was excellent run through. Any questions from the committee for Mr. Wooten? Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Wooten, what percentage of Alaskan teachers currently have the national certification?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, I had that before me, but I can't capture it. But I can certainly get that and provide it to you.
And I can just speak to this. I think it's around 1%, but actually I'm going to pivot to another invited testifier who might have that information. Lisa Parody with ACSA, if you can hear us, can you put yourself on record and speak to Representative Vance's question or zoom out
Thank
as you,
Mr.
please,
Chairman.
As well? Yes, loud and clear.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the chair, Representative Vance, as of 2019, Alaska ranks 25th in the nation with 2.57% of Alaska teachers recognized with national board certification. And so we believe, ACSA believes, a goal of 4% is an ambitious goal, but it's an appropriate goal to encourage teachers to pursue certification.
And Mr. Chairman, I appreciate my partner, colleague, Dr. Parody, for bailing me out. I found that as she was speaking.
It's a team effort here. I'll just pause. Any other questions for Mr. Wooten, Representative Story?
Thank you, Chair. Rep Story, wanted to thank both Mr. Wooten and Dr. Parody for their work on student achievement, critically important. My question has to do with, I can remember in prior, if you can confirm the cost to do, to get your National Board certification and how long that process takes.
Yes, Representative Story, through the chair. It's a little over $400 for each of the four elements that teachers are required to show competence to get that. So you know, in the neighborhood of $1,700 would be the cost for a teacher to attain that National Board certification.
Follow up. And how long does that process take?
Well, it's a self-paced process, and they're given a time limit to complete it, and before they have to start over again. But it's adequate time. As I recall, I think it's about 2 years.
Okay, and one more follow-up.
Yes.
Do you know if districts pay their teacher certification cost to get that, or is it dependent upon the teacher to be able to afford the certification?
Through the chair, Representative Story, that's obviously a local decision, local school district decision, and I'm not aware of whether districts pay for that or require teachers to do that. I don't have that information.
Thank you.
I think at this time, just given that we're at 3:52 and wanting to provide a little bit of buffer for the Department of Administration Finance Subcommittee, may wrap up consideration of this legislation, but I'll coordinate with invited testifiers to see if we can have them back in the next meeting and continue invited testimony as well as committee questions. So we'll take up HB 18 again on Thursday, and the next meeting, for the record, is 3 p.m. here in the Max Grunberg Room, Thursday, March 4th. Please also take note, after we gavel out, we'll sign the committee paperwork on Representative Johnson's House Bill 3. So don't split too quick. And thank you, Tom, as well as House Records, for facilitating today's meeting, as well as Jeff Stepp. It's his first day as committee aide. Welcome, Jeff. Welcome to Juneau. And at 3:53, we will adjourn.